Today is Tuesday, February 23, 2021. This is part 13 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Carl Bowman, B-O-W-M-A-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Carl. How are you today?
Good morning, Tom. Oh, I'm doing well.
Great. Carl, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yep, sure do.
Thank you very much. Last time, we were just getting up, I think, to 1991, as your helpful reminders indicate here, and you got involved with air quality regarding the Mojave Generating Station, which is a coal-fired power plant west of the park. Can you pick that thread up?
Sure. So, yeah, we've been kind of jumping around talking about some of my other job responsibilities, but air quality was the part of my job in resource management that eventually ate all the rest of them. Mm. And so 1991 was actually the year I started that job, and at that point air quality was still just a part of my job along with the pest management stuff and water quality stuff that we've already talked about. To just kind of back up a tiny bit to 1990, Congress had amended the Clean Air Act, and a lot of my air quality stuff grew out of those amendments. And one of the things that drove them was the big controversy or whatever over putting controls on the Navajo Generating Station.
Hmm.
That study had been done before I came to Grand Canyon. It was just, just the final conclusion shortly after I arrived. But basically, two things grew out of that. One was a feeling that, okay, the Navajo Generating Station processed the scientific study and then the decision to clean it up had been so contentious and so long and drawn out that nobody really wanted to go through it again. And so in the Clean Air Act amendments, Congress said, okay, to deal with these kind of visibility impacts coming from these big, from any sources, visibility impacts in national parks and wilderness areas, they wanted to establish what they called visibility transport commissions, and gave the states the option to do that, but required one be created for Grand Canyon National Park.
Hmm.
And so that led to the Grand Canyon Visibility Transport Commission. The other thing that happened was they said, okay, we found all these big impacts from a power plant at one end of the Grand Canyon, the Navajo Generating Station off to the northeast. What about this other big power plant southwest of the Grand Canyon? And that was the Mojave Power Project. And so they directed that EPA do a study of the Mojave plant to see what impacts it had. And so that kind of put EPA in the driver's seat.
Okay.
The Mojave Power Plant was operated by Southern California Edison. And so they started putting together a study of that plant. And the groundwork for it, I mean, you know, the Park Service, the Air Resources Division out of the Washington office up in Denver, they had been involved in the study design because it was our responsibility to protect Grand Canyon visibility. But EPA was the one that had kind of the driver's seat in terms of designing the whole thing, in terms of what we were going to look at, how we were going to do it, and that sort of thing.
Okay.
What they came up with was a one-year study so that you would get, you know, the impact across the seasons. It ran from September of the data collection, ran from September of 91 to September of 92. And what they did was they wanted to make a regional study out of it. One of the complications of the Mojave Power Plant is that if the wind is blowing towards Grand Canyon from the Mojave plant, it's also, depending on how far upwind you go, it can be coming from Los Angeles or Tijuana, little shift, and it could be coming from Las Vegas. And so how are you going to tease out the signal from the Mojave power plant against all these other potential sources?
Right.
And so consequently, the study design that they came up with was like, okay, we're going to look at this for a year. And during that year, the weather patterns are such that we want to do two intensive studies, one during the winter and one during the summer. Each of the intensives would last about 2 months to get a look at those characteristic weather patterns that you find those time of the year. The spring and the fall, things are, they don't have so much their own weather pattern as that it's kind of a flux, a change from the summer pattern to the winter pattern. And so that was kind of the general design. They looked at Southern California, Southern Nevada, Southern Utah, Arizona, and they also went a little ways, I believe, I can't remember for sure, but I think that they had a couple of sampling sites in southwestern Colorado and northwestern New Mexico as well.
So maybe a dozen sampling sites in all throughout the Southwest?
And different sites had different degrees of intensity of data collection. You know, at Grand Canyon, we were we were the prime object of the study, so we had lots of stuff going on.
Okay.
And a lot of it was an enhancement of the regular air quality monitoring that we did. So instead of during, they added on some equipment and intensified others. So our particle sampling, instead of being twice a week, was for, you know, 24 hours a day, twice a week. We did it for daily samples. We added added cameras to just do a visual documentation. Normally, we took three pictures a day looking west from on top of the watchtower out at Desert View. We switched that so that we had three cameras looking in different directions from the top of the watchtower. And then we also had a movie camera that took one frame. Oh, gosh, what was it? I think it was one frame every 5 minutes. But anyway, you would get a, it was basically to make a time lapse of how conditions changed throughout the day. And then we also added on other equipment. They were releasing an inert gas tracer from the stacks at Mojave, and so we had samplers designed specifically to collect that tracer gas, and then they were also releasing tracers from other sources, Los Angeles Basin, I think Las Vegas, and that kind of stuff, so that they could, you know, by looking at these different tracer gases, that would give them an idea of where the air was coming from, whether it had actually passed over the Mojave plant or was coming from Los Angeles or Las Vegas or combinations of all that. And so we got all that kind of stuff set up. It was a big enough sampling program that I actually turned over some of the monitoring out in the Desert View area, the cameras and the transmissometer that we had set up out there, over to staff at Desert View, and they maintained those while I concentrated on the stuff that was in closer to the village.
Okay.
And then we also had some studies that were contracted to Brigham Young University, where they were using slightly different sampling techniques, but looking for some of the same information, so that it, you know, it would help. Well, it kind of depends on how you look at strategy. It would help by confirming the two different techniques could help by confirming each other's results. But if they didn't confirm each other's results. It helps to confuse things.
Yes.
So,
interesting.
So that was going on at the same time.
In the Visibility Transport Commission, I'm assuming EPA had a representative. Grand Canyon National Park had a representative. Southern California Edison had a representative.
Nope.
Really?
Well, yes and no. The Visibility Transport Commission was kind of on a parallel track. They, okay. Project Mojave, the Mojave Power Project, was the biggest source of sulfur dioxide in the West.
Okay.
That was not installing controls. There were bigger power plants. There's the Navajo Generating Station was bigger. But they were installing or would be installing controls for their sulfur dioxide. And then the biggest was a plant called Centralia up in Washington State. And they were also scheduled to be installing controls. So a lot of the work of the Visibility Transport Commission was kind of, I don't want to say that their work was preliminary, but portions of it were preliminary based on the results of what the outcome of the Mojave study was going to be.
Okay.
So it was kind of an unknown in there. So the Mojave study went on, and we did our work at the canyon. It was from my standpoint, I was doing the data collection. I wasn't doing analysis or any of the computer modeling or anything like that.
Was the EPA doing that? Who was or was it Denver, the Air Resources Unit there? Who was doing the data crunching?
The data crunching was the responsibility of whatever network or whether it was a university or consortium or EPA or the Park Service, whoever was running a particular monitoring network that was feeding data into the number crunching. And then EPA and Southern California Edison were cooperatively working together on those results, putting them into the models and trying to figure out what it all meant. And we did have, even in the data collection issue or data collection part of it that I was involved in, we did run into some issues. That was where I first learned the excuse, explanation, whatever, where I would get scientists working in the park on special studies or upgrades or whatever, and we're standing out there in the middle of the pinyon juniper woodland with our mediocre power and telephone connections and that kind of stuff. And they look at it and say, I just don't understand. This worked fine in the lab.
Hmm.
Like, well, this isn't the lab anymore.
Right.
And, excuse me, one of them happened with Mojave, where they had come up with a weatherproof system for their controllers and all that kind of stuff. And it was in an ice chest, which was a good weatherproof container, helped to stabilize temperatures for the electronics and all that kind of stuff. And then they drilled holes inside of the ice chest for all the wires to run out. And then the wires, signal wires, power wires, whatever, would run out across the snow for the winter intensive and out to the different monitoring equipment. And I don't remember exactly how it came up, but when the park safety officer saw all of these electrical cables running through the snow up there at Hopi Fire Tower, he became concerned, let's say. And so we had to do some major equipment redesigns on the fly up there to make everything safe. Indian Garden, we had sampling going on down at Indian Garden and at Phantom Ranch, and they were running into problems. The equipment didn't like the power failures and brownouts that sometimes happen down there. and we were having to kind of nurse the equipment along and that sort of thing. So there were, you know, data collection wasn't simply just going out in the field and collecting the filters and downloading the data. There was a lot of hands-on work going on with it.
And what did you find after a year's worth of data gathering?
Well, excuse me. It took until 1998 before the data was finally crunched enough that they could draw some conclusions from it. And what they discovered was basically the visibility impacts from the Mojave plant were very, very obvious around Bullhead City because it's right across the river from the plant.
Right.
And it was also fairly obvious out at Meadview at the west end of Grand Canyon. But in Grand Canyon Village, the impacts were not particularly great just because of the mixing in the atmosphere that happened between the plant and Grand Canyon.
Okay.
When transport was from the Mojave plant to the South Rim, there was enough mixing of sources in the LA Basin in Phoenix or in Las Vegas that there were periods of time, and I'm talking, you know, like a day or a fraction of a day, when there was a very, very clear signal that the Mojave plant was the primary contributor. But most of the time, it was a mixture of all those different sources that were causing the impairment. And as we expected, the impacts in the village area were mostly in the summertime. Winter airflow just doesn't tend to move quite that direction. But in the western part of the canyon, the wintertime impacts, when the plume would settle in those desert basins out there, that's when they were seeing their big impacts.
Okay. All right. And then, so what did you do about that?
Well, it all fed into the recommendations of the Grand Canyon Visibility Transport Commission. So the plant operator, well, Southern California Edison was the plant operator, so they were going to have to foot the bill for whatever whatever emission controls went online.
Okay.
And they used a lot of the same strategies that they had used in the Navajo Generating Station settlement, where they were looking at, okay, we can add scrubbers to the plant, and the more efficient the scrubbers are, the more expensive they are, obviously. And so what they would do is they would trade off time versus efficiency. Time to install the scrubbers, time that the scrubbers had to be operational up to a certain capacity and that sort of thing. And I may have mentioned this with the Navajo Generating Station. One of the things that they did was delay the installation so that basically, by delaying the installation, it lets Southern California Edison keep money in the bank and make interest on it.
Right.
And then the other time thing would be to change the averaging time. So you would say, okay, I want these scrubbers to be 95% effective. And it's kind of like, okay, that sounds like a good number. But is that 95% effective 100% of the time?
Oh, interesting.
Of the time, 75% of the time, and so they would trade on those numbers and find a figure that the percentage effectiveness of the scrubber versus the averaging time for how long, or, you know, whether it was an hour or a day or whatever. They would come up with a figure so that they only had to build scrubbers for the plant, but they didn't have to have standby scrubbers in case one of them broke down. They could fix the broken down scrubber and then operate it at a higher efficiency so that they would still meet the averaging time efficiency that was required by the settlement.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. And so I guess to jump to the end of the story, they came up with this agreement. They came up with, okay, you know, the Mojave Power Plant will put on these kind of scrubbers operating at this kind of efficiency, and they will be installed, you know, at this time. Well, as things turned out, the plant's coal contracts up on the Hopi and the Navajo nations ran out about the same time, and Southern California Edison, the tribes were getting increasingly upset about the amount of water that was being used to slurry the coal from Black Mesa to the Mojave Power Plant.
Right.
And so they weren't sure that they wanted to renew the licenses.
Hmm.
Consequently, the plant operators weren't so sure that they wanted to invest a whole bunch of money into pollution controls if they weren't going to be able to operate the plant.
Right.
And so eventually it all boiled down to, well, they didn't have their coal supply nailed down when it came time to start ordering the pollution control equipment. They deferred installing the pollution or ordering the pollution control equipment, and then decided to shut the plant down instead.
Okay.
Because they weren't coming to an agreement on the coal. So they shut the Mojave plant down. Oh gosh, I don't remember when that was. About 2005, maybe. Anyway, at some point they did shut the plant down.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, a friend of mine told me that when they laid everybody at the plant off, they told them it was because Greenpeace was shutting them down.
Yeah. And, Well, the other thing that was
absolutely nothing to do with the entire project.
The other thing that was happening was the price of coal was starting to become uneconomical when looked at the price of natural gas, and that was happening
right.
Countrywide.
Right, and we'd even seen that. I'd attended some of the scoping meetings for a big natural gas power plant south of Kingman that was eventually built. It's right there by I-40.
Okay.
South of Kingman. So it was kind of early on in that process, but it was the beginning of the end for these big coal-fired power plants.
Right.
They were getting less and less economically feasible.
And of course, the Navajo Generating Station went offline a year ago, 2 years ago, and now it's come down. So
now it's being demolished.
Yeah,
and it's basically because they can't compete with natural gas.
Right.
So
okay, interesting.
So that was the Mojave. Another just kind of interesting. Sidelight on it is that, you know, we were studying this power plant. The name of the power plant was the Mojave Power Project. And so the project to study the air quality impacts of it obviously needed to be called the Mojave something or other. And so they needed to come up with an acronym. So Project Mojave, the air quality study, was actually the project it was the measurement of haze and visual effects, which then became an acronym of Mojave.
Okay.
So when properly stated, the word Mojave is always in all caps because it's an acronym.
Ah.
Yeah, a friend of mine said, oh, yeah, when we do one of these studies, the first thing we have to do is come up with an acronym to name it. So.
Huh, that's right, and... So that's capitalized and visual effects.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
So it was, you know, like I say, the Project Mojave I was pretty much just involved in the data collection, which was more than a full-time job during the intensives. During the intensives, I was frequently working six-day weeks and
wow.
and then, you know, stuff, just keeping everything going, and or trying to get things back going again, or whatever.
Right. These are fragile machines. They break down easily and often, it seems like. And require a lot of...
There are environmental controls. Some of the instruments, you know, it doesn't, the temperature doesn't matter at all. They can work in whatever. Others of them have to be in a very specific temperature range. They need good power, and all that kind of stuff. So, during the summer intensives, you know, lightning strikes, power failures, you know, that would... They would all take their toll.
Okay. So that was then 91, 92, and then you followed that along until 98-ish when that...
Yeah, I was, in terms of after the data collection was done, you know, I would still have to talk about it, but I really wasn't involved per se in... the number crunching and all that kind of stuff. I was watching the progress. One, because it was my park, and two, because we were then in the throes of the Grand Canyon Visibility Transport Commission through much of that, and were trying to get the data so we knew what our recommendations would be.
Okay. So, have we talked about the Visibility Transport Commission? I'm looking at my notes. I don't think we've talked about that. Can you kind of open that up a little bit?
Okay. Well, the like I said, it was part of the 1990 amendments to the Clean Air Act, and Congress said that the states could enter into visibility transport commissions along with the relevant federal management agencies. That were, and it was focused on Class 1 areas. So Class 1 areas were these large national parks and wilderness areas in existence when the 1977 amendments were passed to the Clean Air Act that had the most stringent controls on increases in air pollutants.
Okay.
And like I said, Congress said states could do this, but that a Grand Canyon Visibility Transport Commission would be established. So it was, and so we started looking at the states that had the potential to contribute haze to the Grand Canyon, because the purpose of the Visibility Transport Commissions was haze. It wasn't other air pollutants.
Okay.
Although they factor in. And so, obviously, Arizona, California, Nevada, but we were also looking at the power plants in the Four Corners area, which have some impact in the wintertime.
So the Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, or certainly Utah, no, certainly New Mexico, because they've got a ton of plants over there.
Right, and then there's a big plant in central Utah.
Okay.
Wyoming, in the southwest corner of Wyoming, there's big coal-fired power plants up there,
which is in the Green River arm of the Colorado River.
Right, right.
Okay.
And then an important clean air corridor. A lot of the best days in Grand Canyon, the air comes in over Oregon.
Wow.
And Washington. So eventually we had, you know, we said, okay, here's these states, California, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, Oregon, and there was some talk about Washington, but they declined to join. And so the states got together and started hammering stuff out with the federal agencies. At this point, both the Park Service and the Forest Service had large wilderness areas within that region, and also Fish and Wildlife Service had a couple of wilderness areas in New Mexico that were kind of borderline on it. And so we had those three agencies We also had EPA, and EPA was kind of, they were kind of in charge of it, but the federal agencies, it was the states who voted, not the federal agencies. So the federal agencies were part of the commission, but they had no vote in the deliberation.
That's weird.
And then the states did.
Okay.
And at the coordinating meetings, when the whole thing was getting started up, the states kind of gave Arizona the lead, because Grand Canyon. And but they also agreed that, no, we don't want to get involved in one of these visibility transport commissions for every single Class 1 area that we administer. So the entire commission, both the voting and non-voting members, sat down and kind of outlined, okay, it's called the Grand Canyon Visibility Transport Commission, but what Class 1 areas are we actually going to be considering for this? And they identified a number of national parks, all the national parks in Utah, Grand Canyon and Petrified Forest in Arizona. Arizona also had Sycamore Canyon and the Mount Baldy Wilderness areas administered by the Forest Service that were going to be part of it, San Pedro Parks Wilderness in New Mexico, Mesa Verde National Park, and let's see, what was it? Wyminooch and Flat Tops, I think, the wilderness areas in Colorado. So basically, these Class 1 areas of the Colorado Plateau were going to be covered by the Visibility Transport Commission. And so we had our first meeting, and the commissioners decided that it was going to be a public process, which was going to be a good thing, and they were going to put together, you know, a public advisory committee to guide them. And that decisions would be reached on the basis of consensus. And I remember one of the first meetings I went to of the public advisory committee, and it's kind of like, okay, we've got the Sierra Club here, we've got Phelps Dodge here, we've got the Wyoming Mining Association
here,
all the big utilities, National Parks and Conservation Association, and we're going to do this by consensus. Can't see this happening at all. But it did. So we had a number of committees. There was a technical committee to come up with the modeling and that kind of stuff. The public advisory committee to do public outreach, and a communications committee to deal with getting word out to the public and facilitate communication among the different committees in the commission. One thing that happened early on was that they invited several of the tribes to be part of the public advisory committee. And one thing about the Clean Air Act is that tribal nations are essentially equivalent to states in the administration of the Clean Air Act.
Okay.
So the Clean Air Act, basically the act, Congress's job, is to set the goals for what clean air means, whether it's health impacts, visibility impacts, all those sorts of things. Then the EPA is charged then with coming up with the numbers that meet those goals. So how much ozone is a health hazard? How much haze is a visibility impact? And that sort of thing. So EPA takes the goals of Congress and sets the numeric standards. Then the states and the tribes are then responsible for coming up with the programs to meet the EPA standards to achieve the congressional goals. And if the states put together their plans, EPA looks at the plans, and if the states or tribes' plans meet the goals, then the state state goes forward, the tribe goes forward. If they don't, then EPA works with the state or the tribe to modify the plan so it will meet those goals, or a state or a tribe can just decide, nope, I'm not going to do this. And then EPA steps in and creates their own plan.
Okay.
And,
so it behooves the states to participate because they may get a little more diluted plan than if the EPA came in on their own.
Or they might get a more stringent plan than they would like.
Right. That's what I mean. We're saying the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
They might get a more stringent plan than they would like if the EPA did it on their own.
Right. So generally speaking, so you have FIPS, SIPS, and TIPS. FIPS is the federal implementation plan. SIPs are the state implementation plan, and TIPS are the tribal implementation plans.
Okay.
And generally speaking, states are very big on having a state implementation plan. They don't want the feds to do it. Tribes, on the other hand, generally have TIPS because a lot of tribal nations don't have the expertise on hand to create this whole implementation plan under the Clean Air Act to meet all these numeric goals that EPA has set, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
And so EPA winds up doing a federal implementation plan for the different tribes.
Okay.
And different tribes will take different parts. So they might do their own plan for visibility, but leave ozone up to EPA or something like that. So we had invited some of the tribes to become members of this public advisory committee. And at the first meeting, the tribe said, you guys, we are not part of the public. We have the capability, and in some cases have the programs, to administer an implementation plan, same as the states. We should be commissioners. And there was some haranguing going on and this, that, and the other. But eventually, an equal number of tribes were admitted to the commission as well.
Uh-huh.
And it seems kind of odd, but the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission was also included as kind of a non-voting member to balance the federal land management agencies. So it wasn't perfect, but it was one of those early attempts to recognize tribal sovereignty and integrate the tribes into this sort of thing.
Cool.
And there were some interesting friction points, but also some just really good working relationships that got established through that process.
Nice. You know, one of the things that I'm thinking about during this time as well, and I think we talked about this in some earlier interviews, was the LA Basin went through some huge cleanups with going to leaded fuel and some other cleanup activities there in the basin. So those activities would have positively assisted air quality in Grand Canyon.
That's one of the things that both Arizona and California both would harp on that.
Oh, okay.
It was both in the Grand Canyon Visible Air Transport Commission and then in other air quality management issues that I got involved with later, was a selling point for them that, not only will this make the air in Phoenix cleaner, but it also will make the air in Grand Canyon cleaner.
I see.
Or
right.
Los Angeles or whatever. The other thing that happened right about that time was that the LA Basin saw a big drop in their pollution levels, and everybody was just climbing over everybody else to take credit for it.
And how did that happen again? Was it fuel changes or what did it?
Well, part of it was all the pollution controls, changing unleaded gas, this, that, and the other. But
right, because they got
part of it was climate change.
Okay.
Because as the LA Basin warmed up, the top of the inversion layer that capped the pollution in the LA Basin eventually got high enough that the pollution could spill out through the passes into the Imperial Valley.
Oh, interesting.
And dilute the pollution in Los Angeles. So it was a combination of pollution controls and climate change. So it was, but you know, we did a lot of work on the in the Transport Commission, coming up with different strategies that would reduce pollution, the haze causing pollution over the Colorado Plateau. And a big factor there was these big coal-fired power plants, because things like Mojave, Navajo Generating Station, the one up in Utah Delta, the Four Corners and the San Juan Generating Station in New Mexico, they were built out in the middle of nowhere,
right,
on purpose, because they figured, okay, yeah, we'll build these big things, but the pollution will be so far away that it won't bother anybody.
Right, it'll dilute out.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, back the old saying was, the solution to pollution is dilution. And it turned out that, okay, yeah, we're diluting it, but not where we want to be.
Right.
And so they were under the microscope. Copper smelters in southern Arizona for a long time had been, and they were one of the big players in the Transport Commission, both in southern Arizona and the Wasatch Front. But a lot of those smelters had already installed some pretty good pollution controls, and they were turning their emissions into sulfur dioxide into sulfuric acid that then they could sell.
Okay.
So they were making progress or going out of business, because a lot of copper was coming from Chile. But,
right.
So there was a lot of horse trading going on. And the other thing that started to become a bigger and bigger issue was smoke from prescribed fires.
Uh-huh.
Because the federal land managers, by this time, were starting to implement a lot of what we then called prescribed fires and then management fires and this, that, and the other. But basically, mm-hmm. you know, going out and lighting fires in the woods, which caused haze.
Oh, yeah, lots significant. Sure.
Yeah, yeah. Some of the worst haze episodes that we had at Grand Canyon were from our own fires, and from wildfires in California. So it was interesting. I was sitting in. I was the vice chair of the communications committee, and I was sitting in on a meeting of the subcommittee dealing with wildland fire. And there was a guy from the Salt River Project, and some of the New York folks were, why is that power plant guy here? Because he's making sure that you guys give up as much as they're giving up over in the Point Source Committee.
Uh-huh.
So there was a lot of that going on. We eventually did come up with the whole goal of the Visibility Transport Commission was to come up with recommendations to the EPA to restore visibility on the Colorado Plateau. And so the Transport Commission itself did not have the power to go in and say, this plant will do this, or these land managers will do that. Instead, what they were doing was coming up and with a plan that said to EPA, okay, for regional haze recommendations, here's what we agree is the best route forward to restoring natural visibility over the Colorado Plateau. Over a certain time frame. And so we came up with our draft plan, or our draft recommendations, and then the communications committee, of which I was co-chair eventually. I wasn't originally, but I wound up in that position. We had each of the committees had a federal and a state co-chair.
Wow. Okay.
To kind of reflect the makeup of the commission, and so my co-chair was from Utah, from the Utah Department of Environmental Quality, and our job was, like I said, to facilitate communications, but we worked very closely with this public advisory committee, because all of the information that was developed by the technical committees was going into the public advisory committee, and then they were the ones that it was a very, very large committee. Like I said, you know, folks from all the way from mining and utilities to environmental groups and that sort of thing, they were the ones that were actually hammering out the recommendations that that the commission would eventually vote on.
Okay.
And so we worked very closely with the public advisory committee on crafting the recommendations and then getting them out to the public. And so we held a series of public meetings all across the Western United States. And I ran one in Phoenix, and this was, you know, during a flare-up of the sagebrush, minor flare-up of the Sagebrush Rebellion.
Okay.
And nobody wanted to do the one in Reno.
Mm.
And so I wound up having to fly up to Reno.
Wow.
The chair of the committee.
And how did that meeting go?
And so I flew up to Reno and ran the committee, or ran the public meeting. And it actually went pretty well.
Uh-huh.
Some of the written comments were pretty nasty, but I pulled off the meeting. It went reasonably well. I didn't have to call the cops. I wasn't tarred and feathered.
Well, it was interesting because I know the Sierra Club, maybe in conjunction with other environmental groups, the Grand Canyon Trust, maybe the National Parks Conservation Association, ended up bringing litigation against Southern Cal Edison because it seemed that Southern Cal was dragging their heels on putting scrubbers on this plant.
Right, right. And the three groups that you mentioned, they were all part of the Visibility Transport Commission.
Okay.
And but yeah, you're right. It was outside of the commission process, but it was like, no, you guys agreed to this with us, and you're not following through,
right,
and we're going to sue you.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's the way a lot of times those things work. And in fact, I remember there were some meetings where commission meetings where people would say that okay, EPA isn't doing this, blah 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 blah, even though it's required under the act. And the person there from EPA on a couple of occasions said, okay, sue us. If you want us to do that, yeah, we're supposed to do it. We don't have the resources right now to do it.
Hmm.
If it's important enough for you, bring a suit against us and force us to do it.
Uh-huh.
And it's one of those, it's just kind of how the system works sometimes.
Hmm.
Sometimes you can sit down and agree to something and it works out just fine.
Mm-hmm.
Other times it doesn't, and you need a lawsuit to break up the logjam.
Right, right. That's right.
So so we had these meetings. Then I forget, a representative sample of the communications committee got together, compiled over a week's time, a 700-page document summarizing all these meetings across the West that we'd had, presented them to the Public Advisory Committee, and then they debated how to modify the recommendations. The Clean Air Act had given the Transport Commission 4 years to come up with recommendations. And we actually did come up with the recommendations in 4.5 years.
And what were they?
There's a whole book of them.
Just in a broad brush, you know, three or four, kind of how would you synthesize that
there
down?
There were a number of recommendations. One of them was to establish a sulfur dioxide cap for the Colorado Plateau and areas draining into it. I forget exactly what the boundaries of it were, but each facility that emitted sulfur dioxide would be allotted so many tons of SO2.
Okay.
And they could emit that many. If they emitted more, they would have to buy the permits from somebody who had installed pollution controls and had excess tons of SO2 that they could sell to them. And so it established this cap and trade for SO2 across the West.
Uh-huh.
And then starting in a given year, the cap would gradually decline so that the total emissions of SO2 in the region would go down.
Okay.
There were a whole series of...
Was that, I'm sorry, I'm going to jump in here. Was that the first time that this cap and trade concept was used? I know it's very popular now, especially with renewable resource people looking at carbon footprints.
I don't think it was the first time it had been used. I think California had been doing it internally for some pollutants. So I don't think we were the first ones, but recommending that it be applied across multiple states, I think, may have been the first time there.
Okay.
And we were looking at, you know, one of the recommendations was reducing the amount of sulfur in on-road diesel fuel.
Uh-huh.
That diesel fuel had a lot more sulfur in it than it does now.
Hmm.
And that was one of the recommendations that eventually was implemented. So was the SO2 cap and trade. A whole series of, at that time, prescribed fire. We were still kind of feeling our way as to how to reduce emissions. There wasn't a lot of science behind it yet. There was a lot of modeling and that sort of thing. But there were recommendations for managing the amount of smoke that would come out of these prescribed fires. It was the whole thing was broken down into a variety of categories. So like point sources, like big factories and that sort of thing. Area sources like fire,
mm-hmm.
and things like that. And then specific recommendations for each of those. And then the goal was then that these recommendations would be presented to EPA. And then EPA then would use them to create the regulations to manage haze over the states that were part of the Transport Commission. And it was kind of interesting. We came up with them. It was a big deal. We had the governors all showed up. We had a meeting in the Shrine of the Ages where they voted to on their consensus basis. They had to come up with a definition of consensus that would allow Nevada to vote against them. The state of Nevada was pretty much taking their marching orders from the mining industry.
Oh, interesting.
Association of Mining or whatever.
Hmm.
And they did not like them.
Okay.
And Nevada was the one abstain or the one negative vote from the commissioners. But they had a big meeting there in the Shrine of the Ages, and then agreed to the list of recommendations, and then had a ceremony on the rim over, I believe it was over by Colt Studio, where they handed the book of recommendations to the EPA administrator.
Hmm. What year was that? Do you remember?
That would have been, I believe it was 1975. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was in June of 75. Or, I mean, 95.
Thank you, because I'm like,
not 75, yeah.
75, wait a minute.
Yeah, we went back in time so we could nip the problem in the bud.
That's a good idea. That's a super, yeah. Saved a lot of work. 1995, okay.
So, yeah, we passed it off, and then it was kind of, everybody took a deep breath, and that was pretty much the end of the Grand Canyon Visibility Transport Commission, and I was quite pleased with it. It was,
I bet,
probably one of the biggest things I'd been involved with, because even though the communications committee wasn't charged with developing the recommendations, we were working very closely with the people who were to kind of keep them on track and say, well, okay, over in this committee, these guys are talking about this and they're talking about that. And we had the communications committee had actually hired professional facilitators
mm-hmm.
to come in and work with the different committees on, you know, how to come to consensus on things, different stages of agreement that you can totally disagree over my dead body,
right.
Kind of disagreement. You can totally agree like this is the only answer. You can agree that, okay, this is okay. You can agree to not disagree. I don't like this, but I'm not going to stand in the way, and that kind of stuff. And just laying all these different options out to people.
Mm-hmm.
And we would have strategy sessions with the facilitators, you know, over which committees were working smoothly and which ones needed more help and that kind of stuff. So we were doing a lot of the behind the work or behind the scenes work to facilitate coming to the recommendations.
And I'm assuming lots of travel, lots of meetings all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm thinking today we're doing all that by Zoom, but in the day.
We did do conference calls.
Okay.
I was traveling pretty frequently. Most of our meetings, we'd have them in Phoenix.
Okay.
At DEQ, Desert Research Institute out in Las Vegas, Utah Department of Environmental Quality. We had meetings in Santa Fe.
So while you were traveling for that, you had to keep the machines going as well. So that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This sounds like a lot of things to take care of at once.
Yep, it was. So we wrapped that up, and then it was time to implement them.
Okay.
And so the Grand Canyon Visibility Transport Commission dissolved / morphed into what became known as the Western Regional Air Partnership, which formed, it included more states, Washington, Idaho, and Montana.
This was 1995.
1995, we started thinking about it. It took a while to get the whole thing up and running. And now it's pretty much run under the auspices of the Western Governors Association.
Okay.
So
you know what? Let's maybe this is a good time to put a comma in this interview.
Okay.
And next time we'll unpack the Western Regional Air Partnership and how the Transport Commission recommendations were implemented.
Okay.
Anything else you want to add into before we head in that direction to what you've just covered?
Not really. I guess the one thing I would say is that, you know, even though it was towards the beginning of my air quality work, the Grand Canyon Visibility Transport Commission was what pretty much made it clear that air quality was going to eat up my whole job.
Huh.
So yeah. The water quality and the pest management kind of fell by the wayside. Hmm. I actually started getting help, volunteers, and eventually even part-time paid employees to help me run the monitoring program, the logistics of going out and changing the filters and stuff every day.
And meanwhile, by the end of the 1990s, Linda Mazu, your boss, had left. And you had a couple of series of different resource management heads thereof, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, we did. I had the one thing was the commissioners for the Visibility Transport Commission. Like I said, it was the governors of the states, although not always. California, it was the head of the California Air Resources Board.
Well, no, I was thinking about your immediate boss at Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
At the Science Center.
Yeah. Well, Linda Mazu was my boss. She was my direct supervisor. And she was, she was my last supervisor.
Okay.
my first and my last supervisor who really understood air quality. That's not to say that I didn't have good supervisors after that, but right. They didn't know quality like Linda did.
Got it.
And
got it.
They pretty much left me to run on my own.
Okay.
And then the Park Service Commissioner in the Grand Canyon Visibility Transport Commission was delegated down to Rob Arnberger, superintendent. Well, actually, he wasn't at first. It was Bob Chandler who was superintendent first, and then Rob inherited the mantle.
Got it.
And so for the Visibility Transport Commission work, I was working more with the Washington office and the superintendent's office.
Okay.
Than I was
All right.
Through the chain of command at resource management. That's not to say that I didn't keep my boss out of the loop or anything like that. I was trying
right.
to keep the information going.
Sure.
But through the Transport Commission years, and somewhat after that, into the time that Joe Alston was superintendent, air quality, the Transport Commission was over by the time Joe took over.
Okay.
And the Western Regional Air Partnership was winding down. And so my involvement with the superintendent's office kind of faded away with time. But right up until the end, with the air quality stuff, I was working more with the Air Resources Division in Denver
okay.
and its various contractors than I was working through the hierarchy in the park. And we can talk more about that in the next one, because that
yeah.
really came into play during the Western Regional Air Partnership years.
Okay. All right. That sounds good. Well, with that, let's bring to a close part 13, Grand Canyon Oral History with Carl Bowman. Today is February 23rd, 2021. My name is Tom Martin, and Carl, thank you so very much.
Well, thank you, Tom.